Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with another big encore show. In this week's episode, John Williams from ShadowStats.com, James Turk of Gold Money, and Martin Armstrong, plus the listeners' Q&A session. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another report. Next week, the regular crew and I return to the show, so stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Great to have you back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Time to open up the phone line and reach into the mailbag for listeners' questions and comments.
Hi, Chris. This is Marcus calling. I'm a longtime listener, and I wanted to thank you for the great work you do on your show. It really provides valuable insight. I wanted to let you know about a service that I use that I thought you and other listeners would be interested in. Anyone that's perhaps done some preparation at home to plan for emergency preparedness, maybe put aside some food and water, that type of thing. There's a group of ex-military men, Green Berets, who are really quite exceptional, and they've developed a consulting firm called the Yarborough Group. They'll come into your house and interview you and your family, basically give you a grade in terms of what kind of preparations you've done and if they're adequate or not. They can help you with everything from a fire evacuation plan for you and your children to a survival plan in case communications go down and you need to meet up so that you have a plan in place. So I really think it's an invaluable service. They can be reached at yarboroughgroup.com. It's yarboroughgh-group.com. Thanks, Chris.
Well, hi, Marcus. You know, I can vouch for your comments. You've been a friend to the show for quite some time, and I don't think you'd suggest anything, any service that wasn't legitimate. If you have the means, it does sound like an interesting option to further investigate. But I think for the, you know, the regular bourgeois middle-class folks like myself on a household budget, I'd suggest Lou Rockwell's site. They regularly have excellent articles on household survival preparation. And I presume that everyone listening to our voice has the GoldSeek news updates also bookmarked on every web browser. Thanks, Marcus.
Hi, this is Rick from Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania. A couple of questions from your program from the weekend of January 4th. Harry Dent, who's been pretty right on in recent years, has recommended holding cash. I think that's a good recommendation. However, how do you hold the cash? The G20 meeting formalized the bank bail-in program, so I'm concerned that putting cash in the banks would see it disappear, and I would pull myself out of the fire and shoot myself in the foot at the same time. The next question, when John Emery was making his presentation, you were talking about the performance of gold in Russia, and you indicated that the purchasing power of gold had increased something like 20 times during the crash of the ruble. Is that actual purchasing power, or is it just relative value of the money given that the price inflation was so great? Be interested to hear what you have to say. Thanks a lot. Happy New Year to everyone. Keep up the good work. Goodbye.
Okay, up next, it's Rick from Pennsylvania. He makes comments about Harry Dent Jr.'s interview and holding cash reserves. He asks, what is the best method to do so and keep your assets productive? In previous discussions on and off the air, Harry has suggested on the show that dollar ETFs such as UUP, that's the ticker symbol, which track the U.S. dollar closely, remain in a solid uptrend. Also, I think keeping several months of cash on hand is a solid method. It may seem counterproductive, but keeping cash at home in a fireproof safe can be done now for $20 or $30 on Amazon.com. They'll deliver it free of charge if you have Prime, right to your doorstep or your mailbox. Hidden, Bob Chapman used to point out, the first thing a home invader will do will just pull all the drawers and all the shelves and everything under the bed out onto the floor and rummage through that. That's one of the first things. People think, well, I can hide it in the freezer or in the cupboards or things like that. That's the first thing they do. Under the cushions, the everyday curmudgeon has become a bit more sophisticated. And, you know, when they pick up that little hidden book safe, they'll notice that it maybe weighs a little bit more than the Holy Bible. I don't know how much good that's going to do. Next, Rick discusses John Embry's comments from Sprott Asset Management on the gold/ruble price explosion. I hope I didn't misspeak during that interview, but the increase in gold relative to the ruble was about 100% in just a few months. In fact, it moved from about 44,000 rubles per ounce to over 90,000 near the peak of last year, and it remains high at around 70,000 plus as of today. To put this in context, due to the crude oil plunge, the ruble fell so sharply that a $100,000 investment in gold doubled in value just virtually overnight. From another perspective, and perhaps more troubling, the cost of goods and services, i.e. purchasing power, blasted higher, crushing the purchasing power of those without gold and silver insurance. Food for thought and great questions. Look forward to hearing from you.
Good morning. This is Jeff calling from Denver, Colorado. I had a quick question for Chris regarding the CEF, Central Fund of Canada Limited. He had referenced it some time back ago, and I was wondering if you could give a little bit of detail about it and why he had the recommendation on it. Thank you.
Hi, Jeff. Ticker symbol CEF, or the Central Fund of Canada, is a precious metals ETF with the unusual quality of holding roughly half gold and half silver. In addition, the fund is located outside the U.S., which gives us some additional reduction in exposure to domestic issues and geographic diversification, if you will. Now, several folks I admire feel confident that the soundness of this bullion backing is apparently much higher than most ETFs. But keep in mind, you're unlikely to receive any bullion from these funds in the event of an emergency. So I still think it is something of a paper money scheme. Best for those who wish to trade and perhaps not invest. As for recommending CEF, that would only be a component of a widely diversified portfolio comprised of many competing asset classes. And if you'd like to see the most recent portfolio we have at Alpha Stocks Portfolio, we have a new one each week. I hope you'll log into your Alpha Stocks account. We've had several picks explode in recent weeks. And frankly, over the years, I challenge anyone to say we haven't outperformed the market substantially. And especially those of well-known market pundits.
This is longtime listener George. I have a question. Is it possible that the United States Federal Reserve manipulation be of such magnitude that it's destroying other countries' currencies, friends and foes, to create a positive rate differential, forcing foreign investors to buy our treasury notes so the U.S. government does not have to monetize the debt, and that they're keeping gold manipulated lower. So really, a foreign investor doesn't have very many places he can go except the dollar. Please elaborate on this, and I'd like to hear your comment. Thank you.
Moving on to George asks if the Fed is colluding to make the U.S. dollar more attractive, in particular the U.S. Treasury, by forcing competing currencies like the euro into negative interest rate environment, making the dollar the most attractive currency. Well, first of all, George, where have you been? We were used to regular calls from you here. All right, we're glad you're still kicking, and I think you are correct and you're on the right path, but it might be a bit more involved, I think, than maybe conspiracy. The U.S. is emerging, at least on paper, from a deep recession. Remember, we all threw around the Great Recession term starting around 2007, 2008. With the official national unemployment rate around 5.5%, nearly half of the peak number, the massive QE spending and the rate cuts have to be unwound sometime. And what better time to do it than now, right? I mean, with everybody else, with the market firing on all 12 cylinders, and we have unemployment at the lowest rate in years, inflation well under control, this is sort of the Goldilocks environment for rate hikes. However, the Fed's balance sheet chart, as seen at the St. Louis Fed's webpage, is also showing signs of slowing. That's right. After years of constant increases, you know, it's starting to slow and shows some signs of rolling over, at least at last check. I think this indicates that officials are starting to put the brakes on the economy. Nevertheless, the U.S. dollar has been telegraphing that the sea change event will come to pass within less than about a year. As you know, markets tend to forecast about major changes in the market up to 6 months in advance. The greenback rally has been just one of the most explosive we've seen, maybe with the exception of the silver market circa 2010, 2011. Keep in mind, the U.S. dollar has just undone over 12 years of declines in less than 12 months. It's about 9 months. I would agree with you in theory, George, that trillions of dollars are pouring into the U.S. stock market, treasuries, and dollar-denominated assets, but I would add the proviso that the market was so oversold and so crowded on the downside that a rally was virtually inevitable. Of course, this is easy to say, as hindsight is 100% accurate. George, thanks a lot. We'll hear from you soon, hopefully. Next caller is concerned by a guest who made an extreme comment, noting that nobody knows when a market will crash.
Hey, Chris. This is Andy Johnson. I really enjoyed the interview you had with John Williams and David Morgan and Dr. Mockhill. I just wanted to kind of hint about a little thing that happened to me that dispels a little bit about what Dr. Mockhill said. It seems like whenever any of us use absolutes like never or nobody, we always tend to get ourselves in a little trouble with those. And he said that no one knows when this market is going to start crashing. I noticed that several years ago, an individual I know warned me of an event, a very significant event that happened to America about 4 or 5 months ahead of time. This individual, call him a modern-day fortune teller or prophet or whatever, this actually happened to me, irrefutable. There are individuals out there, I am convinced, that can see these things. I know it sounds very strange, but I would never say anything like that, but it happened to me. And so I'm convinced that there are people out there who know when this market is going to crash. Whether or not they're telling people, I don't know. But I promise you, they're out there and they know it. So I'd just like to, you know, let the listeners know that. I also enjoyed listening to John Williams. He really paints a gleam picture. I think we all need to kind of wake up and start preparing for this thing, because if his numbers are right, this is not going to be good. But anyway, I want to thank you again for efforts in your interviews, and we're all listening. Thank you.
Hi, caller. I think most of my listeners know by now. They know where I stand on prediction and forecasting. Before I give up my boring spiel, I'd like to note that I warned everyone in advance, for instance, of the housing crash on this show. Bob Chapman and I was more vehement, I think, at the time than our late friend, that prices would collapse in 2006 for several years and then recover in 2012. I even, you know, published my humble little wealth building strategies with Wiley Publishing. And I mean, one chapter or two on the subject, which also predicted that silver would explode and rocket from around 14, 15 an ounce to much higher. And it did shoot up threefold. And after the book was published, to well in the range of 50, as we all know. Yes, I do believe there are pockets of predictability as proposed in chaos theory. In addition, my Alpha Stocks newsletter, I think, is prima facie evidence that one man's efforts can top the market. Even the results of folks like Mad Money himself, Warren Buffett, Jim Simons. Still, the evidence shows that these are flukes, that eventually our best forecasts will fail. And unfortunately, it's usually when we're most heavily invested. We're most confident, right? It's when the male gobbler has his plumage fully erect. Well, this is why I advocate diversification with several key tweaks that are outlined in my PhD dissertation. And these are backtested and supported by substantial Excel spreadsheet, which proves via backtesting and forward testing irrefutably that buying and holding can be a devastating investment strategy. Once the dissertation is accepted by the school committee, it will be available online free of charge with the Excel spreadsheets for every index stock sector. It has automatic updates. You just type in the ticker symbol and it instantly updates all of the analysis, which shows how your portfolio would have performed over the last few decades and then how it should perform. This will be available free of charge, as I said, to my Alpha Stocks newsletter. Now, regarding Mr. Williams' analysis, I concur. Hyperinflation will be devastating. It will arrive someday. However, I think the timing is a bit of a difficult matter. Right now, we appear to be facing disinflation. I disagree with a lot of the folks on my show. I do not buy the deflation thesis. I think it's interesting. There is some evidence to support it. But to me, this looks like just a slowing of inflation. Now, slowing of inflation is termed disinflation. So you might think of it as momentum is waning, or you're in your car, you're accelerating, you go up a steep hill, momentum is lost. That would be inflation, but you're increasing, you're going up at a slower rate, a slower pace, i.e. disinflation. Next up, John from Illinois is perplexed by the guest's comments regarding hyperinflation.
Hi, Chris. John from Downers Grove here. I just wanted to comment on Martin Armstrong. I have not yet heard the interview. He is a controversial figure. He's made some good calls in the past. In some way, he displeased the powers that be, and they slapped him in prison for a few years, probably on some trumped-up charges, no doubt. But one of the things that kind of sticks in my craw about Armstrong, he claims there is no such thing as hyperinflation. Then I would like to know from Mr. Armstrong, how do you explain Weimar Germany, Zimbabwe, and Argentina? Let's go down. We can probably add another 100 countries to that list. They've all experienced hyperinflation. I don't know where he's getting this idea that hyperinflation has never existed anywhere in the world. It exists. It's real. And as you well know, every single fiat currency has gone down in flames, usually in a hyperinflationary scenario. So that kind of makes me doubt the veracity of his other views, because he's in denial of one of the great facts of life, monetary facts of life, that hyperinflation is part and parcel of all fiat money systems. They eventually all end in hyperinflation. There you have it. I'm looking forward to hearing what Mr. Armstrong said on the show. I just downloaded it, and I'll be listening to it this morning. And keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
John, sometimes I think comments are taken out of context. I doubt if Mr. Armstrong or anyone believes that hyperinflation is a myth. I think what was intended to be conveyed was that the U.S. won't face a bleak future, that deflation is the true threat. I've made my viewpoint on inflation for a decade on Goldseek, so I won't go into the minutiae, but I do agree with you. Eventually, the U.S. and the entire global fata morgana will evaporate, just like a mirage on the desert horizon. The exact order of these events, I think, remains unknown.
I signed up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter, and I actually forgot my user ID and password. So I was wondering how I retrieve that. Just when I go to the subscriber section, does it give me a way to like renew my password, the newsletter? But if someone can at least let me know how I can retrieve my user ID and password so I can get into the newsletter again, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
The next caller would like to reset his login info on the Alpha Stocks newsletter. Well, no problem at all. Just send a message, please, to gsradio@frontier.com, and I'll send over your updates.
Hi, Chris. John from Downers Grove calling. You know, I heard a great interview with Daniel Ammerman. He's a certified financial planner, about the tax treatment of gold and silver bullion as collectibles. He's got an interesting article on his website about this, showing how gold and silver bullion, the tax rate right now on it, according to Ammerman, is 28% since it's classified as a collectible. But he speculates that in any meltdown of the dollar, there's a very good chance of the tax rate to become punitive. He says 50%. Well, we used to have 90% tax rates in this country. I could see it going to 90%. This is my question. Do you think you could discuss this on your show? And what would be the better way to invest in gold and silver in light of this? Mutual funds, gold mining mutual funds, gold mining stocks, individual stocks, silver mining stocks, closed-end fund like Central Fund of Canada? I'd love to hear you and a guest bat this around a bit, because I don't want to be victimized by punitive taxation on my foresight and wisdom for investing my hard-earned savings in gold and silver. Long-term capital gain right now, I think, if you would invest in a gold mining mutual fund, would be 15 to 18%, something like that. Of course, that can always change at the whim of Congress at any time. We all know that. They can even single out gold and silver mining share investors for special attention and impose an even higher tax on them. Appreciate any feedback you can get on this, because it looks like we're going to start kicking off here on a big bull run, and your listeners should be prepared. Sorry to ramble so, but Great show. I listen to it every week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Moving on to John again from Illinois. He asks for the best way to avoid tax penalties with precious metals investments. Well, hi, John. Let me give you some points to ponder that should help alleviate most, if not all, your concerns. During the financial crises that we all know are imminent, paper assets and even hard assets like real estate, supplies, food, stockpiles, water reservoirs out west, etc. These are entirely owned by the government. That's right. During martial law, everything you have is virtually theirs. If it can't be hidden underground, it could evaporate with just an official's pen stroke. So as for punitive tax rates, I propose that we need to look at it from this perspective. Sure, the powers that be could try to slow the inevitable 10,000 foot high, or should I say $10,000 gold price tsunami. But their efforts will likely only encourage shrewd investors to accumulate even more precious metals, as it requires little gray matter to read between the lines when conditions are so dire that officials must step in to stop price advances. It's usually time to move the family into the survival bunker. As for specific tax advice, you know, that's not my forte. As you say, for the time being, some mutual funds receive favorable tax treatments. For my Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers, if you are interested in a gold fund with a 10% dividend yield, I'll post a link in the newsletter this weekend for your eyes only.
Mr. Walczyk, I value the information you disseminate very highly. Perform a great duty to your fellow man. Lately, I've been experimenting with turning rooms of my house into Faraday cages. I've not yet come to a decision on the results. Are the weapons used against us too strong to defend with a simple Faraday cage? I would appreciate your input. Thank you.
Hi, caller. I, too, am a targeted individual, a TI. Please contact me at gsradio@hughes.net, and I'll offer you the best advice that I can, just like the advice I was given by researchers over 15 years ago. I'll try to help you.
Hey, Chris, John from San Diego, formerly Downers Grove, Illinois. Just a follow-up to the tag-teaming that's going on with the Fed, the ECB, and now it looks like the Bank of Japan has now stepped into the fray since Mario Draghi over at the ECB is being restrained by Germany from going on a spending spree, buying all kinds of toxic waste. So here's the report. The Bank of Japan voted 5-4 to accelerate purchases of Japanese government bonds while tripling its purchases of exchange-traded funds and REITs, real estate investment trusts. Now, of course, the Bank of Japan is permitted, apparently by law, to do such things. I wonder if the Fed, who is not permitted to do that by real estate investment trusts and equities, is in reality buying these things through proxies to hide who's actually buying them. There is little doubt in my mind, should the markets crash, that the Fed will use what some have termed the nuclear option and step into the markets through proxies, of course, and begin buying every single thing in sight in order to prop them up until, of course, it is revealed who is really behind the buying. And then the big explosion, it will be a nuclear explosion. When people realize just how much money the Fed is printing in order to prop up markets, this is not going to be pretty. I suspect we long-suffering gold and silver buyers are going to have to wait a while longer before our patience is rewarded. Comments? Thanks for the show. Bye-bye.
Next up, it's John. Third time. He now has moved to sunny San Diego. Hi, John. You know, I really can't speculate beyond the Fed's balance sheet regarding mortgage-backed security housing debt, but I think the official numbers are enormous. This does appear to be their Achilles heel and a primary reason why the Fed is so nervous regarding pulling the trigger on rate hikes. Clearly, higher rates will destroy the value of their mortgage-backed securities in their portfolio, as well as the Treasury debt, as bond values are obviously negatively correlated to rates. Stay tuned. Interesting times ahead. All right. Closing down the phone lines and opening up the mailbag. Only time for one email question today. So we'll move into regular contact Vidya. He's particularly concerned about a global economic reset. I do expect a global reset scenario to play out over the next 5 to 10 years, particularly given the rush away from U.S. dollars by BRICS nation. And regarding the rupee, remember that only gold-backed currencies are insulated from government government profligacy, even the rupee is susceptible to global hyperinflation when it arrives. It appears that the global economic endgame will include a sudden collapse that will catch virtually everyone off guard, in turn making precious metals of incalculable value circa Europe in 1922. Venezuela, Zimbabwe, etc. Think of those outcomes. So I think it's a great question. It's food for thought. We all need to keep this in the back of our minds, and that's why, once again, broken record here, but you've got to have that insurance. Hard money. Closing down the mailbag, remember to call into our toll-free hotline. We have to give our callers the highest priority. All right, coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with this week's guest interviews. So stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Good to be with you.
Start off today with the dollar rally. Since we last talked, it continued even higher. Quite a remarkable rally over a nine-month period, erasing 12 years of losses. But some of our guests here on the show are convinced that this is just a final hurrah, if you will, before an ultimate day of reckoning for the greenback. Any thoughts on what that might mean for investors?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, the fundamental underlying factors for the dollar have not really changed for the better. There's still too much debt. There's still too much government spending. What we've seen is that with interest rates in Europe moving below zero, interest rates in the United States that are still basically above zero make the dollar look like a good alternative. So in that sense, it's an emotional knee-jerk reaction, hot money moving into the dollar and driving it higher relative to the euro and some of the other currencies that have negative interest rates. But, you know, underlying factors still suggest that the U.S. hasn't come to grips with its basic problems. You know, too much government spending, too much debt, too much printing by the money printing by the Federal Reserve. It's causing, you know, problems for the dollar, and, you know, eventually those problems will be realized.
Exactly. It just seems to be the least bad alternative, I guess, around, and money flowing in, it really props up our equities and bond markets. But probably if we saw the big picture, maybe a chart of all the currencies in the world, the long-term downtrend in fiat money would be evident, don't you suspect?
Yeah, clearly. And in fact, if you look at gold versus all of the major currencies of the world, you know, gold is basically up against all of them with the exception of the U.S. dollar, where it's, you know, down a little bit. But, you know, gold is up 10% this year against the euro, for example.
Since you're closer than the rest of us, or most of us here, to the eurozone drama, the Grexit and so many of the issues facing or plaguing the region, do you see this eventually escalating?
Yeah, you know, there's no doubt there are people looking for safe havens. You see it in a lot of different places, a lot of different ways. Housing prices in London, Singapore, and other safe havens are rising. A lot of money is going into collectibles and other forms of tangibles. And money's coming out of a weak spot. There's been a decline in bank deposits in Greece, for example. That money's been coming out of Greece and looking for safe havens. And as a consequence of, you know, these monetary problems that we have in Europe, you know, again, similar to the problems in the United States, over-leveraged governments, too much government spending, not enough wealth creation to service all of these debt obligations, it's going to come to a head. You know, when it's going to happen, it's always difficult to get an exact timing. But so many trends coming together now, Chris, to me, it seems like you can see a lot of volatility coming, you know, pretty soon.
You mentioned recently that the European Central Bank will expropriate deposits in Greek bank accounts to help cover those loans that the bank has made to their government. And I wonder if you could give us an idea of how this aspect of the story could impact the markets.
The European Central Bank did that in Cyprus. They've said that's going to be the blueprint for other countries in Europe that get into trouble. And, you know, Greece is clearly into trouble, so we will see if the European Central Bank will repeat the Cyprus experience again and take away bank deposits from bank depositors after the Greek or after the, you know, the government nationalizes the banks in that country. What it's basically doing, you know, these types of events is they undermine confidence in fiat currency, and fiat currency rests on nothing but confidence. If that confidence disappears, you end up getting what's called a flight from the currency. You know, the demand for that currency declines because of the perceived problems or the monetary illnesses that are affecting that currency. And as a consequence, it loses purchasing power. And it tends to happen over a fairly short period of time, as we've seen really just over the past several months with regard to the euro and how much it's dropped compared to the dollar and even some of the non-euro European currencies like the British pound.
An interesting article from Zero Hedge noted that the New York Fed stockpile of the yellow metal actually dropped below 6,000 tons for the first time in over 100 years. Could the New York Fed and some of its compatriots attempt to manipulate the markets by selling off their stockpile?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is indeed the case. You know, you can keep a lid on the gold price for a certain extent. We saw how this happened in the 1960s, for example, during the London gold pool, where this cartel of central banks got together to keep the gold price at $35 an ounce, even though the market knew that gold was worth more than $35 an ounce. So basically, that was forcing the central banks to keep feeding physical metal into the market at that $35 an ounce price, to try to keep that lid on it. But eventually, the central banks had enough. They threw in the towel and they let the gold price rise. It's basically the same thing this time around, though obviously at a much higher price. Metals coming out of the Federal Reserve in New York as an indication of how tight physical gold is here in London. And there's no doubt in my mind that the metal is coming out of New York in order to help satisfy the strong physical demand for metal that we're seeing pretty much all over the world, but particularly in Asia, which continues to acquire, you know, huge amounts of physical metal. And, you know, China particularly has become now the largest buyer of physical metal every year.
Ambrose Evans-Pritchard published, I thought, a rather interesting article that the U.S. might be making a huge blunder by treating China, our neighbor, as an economic foe, at least allegedly importing a huge, many, many tons per day of gold. And it seems as though we might be setting ourselves up for just a strategic error here. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I do agree that it is a strategic error. You know, China is, depending on who you're measuring, who's measuring it and what time of the week it's being measured, China is either the largest or the second largest economy in the world. It's looking for stature. It's looking for respect in the community of nations. And it's looking for ways to exercise its power. And it's being thwarted of doing that within institutions created by the United States after the Second World War, like the IMF, World Bank, and things like that. So it's not surprising that China is out there creating its own institutions, most recently being the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, where the U.S. was saying to its allies, you know, don't join it because, you know, America wanted to keep its influence in the prime position. But, if, you know, everybody's recognized the writing on the wall that there's a lot of economic activity, a lot of growth potential in China, and a lot of nations around the world have joined that AIIB, despite the fact that the U.S. had asked them not to. You know, as the dominant monetary power after the Second World War, you know, under what's called the Bretton Woods Agreement, and thereafter under this floating currency regime that governments have been following, the U.S. government has this responsibility to the rest of the world to maintain a currency that can be used effectively in international trade. And it's a currency that, like the British pound under the classical gold standard when the British Empire was reigning supreme, it would have it would preserve purchasing power and could be used under a constant rule of law as a neutral tool in commerce. Well, the U.S. government has moved away from that in recent decades and now is using the dollar more as a political weapon rather than a neutral, allowing it to circulate as a neutral tool in commerce. And they're also looking at domestic political considerations rather than geopolitical and geo-monetary situations when from the dollar's role internationally. And that's causing a lot of feedback, and it's impairing the dollar's role. And that ultimately, I think, will decrease the demand for the dollar, and I think is likely to be one of the reasons why the dollar will be heading south as we move toward the end of this year.
Add to your comments, your earlier comments regarding China's appetite for the yellow metal. India is now trying desperately to compete with China's voracious appetite, according to Bullion Star, exploding imports. The race seems to be on to insulate from what they probably perceive as profligacy on an epic scale.
Yeah, well, I think this is going to be an interesting year as we move toward the end of the year. We have a lot of events coming up over the next several months, particularly September, October, November, when the IMF is meeting to determine the reweighting of the special drawing right, the SDR. And we'll see whether or not China is included in the new reweighting of the SDR. If it's not included or if China's not happy with the way it's been treated, I think that could have a profound effect on the global monetary system, which I'm basically thinking would be very bullish for gold and very negative for the U.S. dollar.
If you could tell folks a bit more about goldmoney.com.
Yeah, I'm the founder of Gold Money. We're an online company, goldmoney.com. Very convenient, economical, and safe way to buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and to have that metal stored for you in a number of different vaults around the world to give you a geographic diversification of your precious metal portfolio.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Mr. John Williams, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic resource that's widely acclaimed by many of the folks in the gold community in the mainline media.
Thanks for having me, Chris. We've had some extraordinary distortions in the markets in the last year, particularly since June of 2014. At that point in time, because of the situation in the Ukraine, we saw some actions taken by the U.S., some overtly against the Russian leaders and covertly in the area of trying to knock down oil prices and strengthen the dollar in an effort to create financial stress for Russia. And we were successful in doing that, but that threw off a lot of factors from what I would have expected. Very simply, the where the dollar was played up, where the markets picked up on it, was very much along the lines of the U.S. economy's booming along now, and the Federal Reserve is going to take a more normal monetary policy. They'll start raising interest rates, and all that was used to help rally the dollar. Problem is, the economy never recovered from the big downturn that we had started in 2007 into 2008 into 2009. Worst contraction since the Great Depression. That's official. I'll contend, though, that we did not recover, as the official numbers show, starting in the middle of 2009. You go by the official GDP numbers, the broadest measure that the government publishes on the economy. Mid-2009, the economy began recovering, and by early 2011 had exceeded where it was before the recession. It's just continued growing ever since. You don't see that in any other series. And I'll contend that the underlying reality has been one of a plunge into 2008, 2009, and then basically a period of protracted stagnation. There have been some series that have started to climb, but they have not recovered. So coming into the end of this last year, all of a sudden we're seeing booming GDP reporting, the strongest economic growth in over a decade, which again was not the common experience. You have pockets of weakness and strength, but largely weakness still around the country. What's kept all of this from really becoming a boom, as I'm sure everyone would like to see, has been the consumer. Consumer generally has been strapped for liquidity. Income is not growing, net of inflation. Credit's tough to come by. That's one way you could get beyond not having real growth in income, inflation-adjusted income. Consumer confidence, you hear all the headlines here about how it's recovered, but still, historically, it's at levels that you normally see in a recession. We don't have a recovery with the consumer. If a consumer doesn't have real growth in income, I'm talking here adjusted for inflation, there's no way you can have sustained growth in consumption, again, shy of the debt growth, which is also restricted at this point. And that's more than 70% of the economy. It's also hitting the still the housing market. So all these numbers that we saw last year, towards the end of the year, were just nonsense in terms of what was being reported. There are a number of ways or a number of things that explain that. What you could have expected, indeed what happened, even the official numbers started to turn down in the last several months, enough so that market sentiment is beginning to shift towards the economy certainly being weak in the first quarter. It certainly has been so far in terms of the reporting, and I've been contending that would happen. But even more so that this will be the onset of what will be recognized as a new recession. That's not a circumstance in which the Fed is going to continue to ease, continue to tighten, to move away from easing. And it's the expectation that the Fed would tighten that has probably been the biggest factor behind the strength in the U.S. dollar and in the global markets. That and the expectations of continued economic growth. These economies slowed. We've seen expectations shift on the Fed. You've seen some weakness in the dollar. We still have a long ways to go before we get back to where we were last June. But some in substance, I think the corner's been turned and turned in terms of the mania that we almost had coming into the this year. Again, as the dollar strengthened, it tended to also weaken gold and silver. As we see the economy turn into recession, which still is not broadly anticipated, you'll find the pattern here will accelerate. You'll see greater downturn in the dollar, which in turn will be more inflationary, tend to push oil prices back up. It'll pressure gold and silver prices to the upside. And it's the reversal of what I would refer to as a market craziness of the last 8 months or so that we have ahead of us in the next several months. So that I would see that generally as a time where you're going to see some recovery in the price of gold. And it's a circumstance for the Fed that is just impossible, because what happened here with the central banks, not just the Fed, but the rest of the world, but the Fed leading the pack, was that in the crisis of 2008, the panic of 2008, they were faced with a collapse of the banking system, and they did everything, anything they had to do to keep the system from collapsing. The problem, they did nothing that fundamentally improved things. All they did was they pushed the problems into the future. And now we're in that future. They don't have the options they had back in 2008. It's going to get very difficult. I look for still a panic decline here in the dollar that will be coming along. I can't tell you just when it's going to happen. The timing in something like a panic is somewhat irrational in nature, but everything's in place. And as the more of a sell-off you see in the dollar, the more of a pickup you're going to see in domestic inflation. And that, in turn, is going to become a runaway inflation as the rest of the world begins to not just sell the dollar, but to dump the dollar. Again, this is in the context of all that's happened since 2008. The crisis ahead is going to be extremely difficult. Going to lead to very high inflation and hyperinflation down the road here, so that it's an environment where the individual needs to look at preserving his or her wealth and assets in terms of purchasing power. The best bet on that is holding physical gold and silver that provides you with a store of wealth that rides through the difficult times. And as you come out on the other side, it also is liquid and will tend to preserve the purchasing power of the assets that were put into the gold and the silver.
You know, this idea of inflation, deflation, there's considerable debate. It seems like every time the dollar goes up and commodities sag, the deflationists win the argument, and when the contrary happens, vice versa. What they're interpreting to be deflation might just be disinflation or slowing of the inflation rate temporarily.
Look back at the money supply, and you get into the notional value of the derivatives. It's pretty difficult to put a hard number as to how it would play out, because the normally the exposures are a lot smaller than the notional value. You have a system where the government could intervene and basically freeze the system and prevent some of the collapse that would come with that if you had major defaults, which would then expose people to the notional value in terms of a liability or conceivably an asset. I don't see that. I mean, there are going to be a lot of problems there, but the big issue is going to be the collapse in the dollar. And with that, as the dollar becomes worthless, the rest of it doesn't make much difference, because there's no a hyperinflation. What might be worth $1 trillion today could be, in terms of purchasing power, worth $100.
What about for our listeners who might be scratching their heads saying, but haven't we just seen the greenback erase losses in the blink of an eye? That would seem to indicate underlying strength. You view this as an anomaly, then?
Well, it's a canard. The dollar has been in general decline, and to a certain extent, a matter of a direct policy of the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve over decades. I mean, if you go back to 1970, I think you'll find that the dollar has lost in excess of 90% of its value against the Swiss franc, for example. We have seen some rally all since June of last year. Otherwise, we're pretty much at all-time lows, and that took us to multi-year highs. But I think that was largely an artifact of what was being done to, try and damage the Soviets and maybe trying, not the Soviets, so the Russia, at the same time perhaps trying to give some troubled European systems a little bit of a breather. The problem is those who think that the U.S. dollar is the strong currency against the rest of the world, they're missing the mark. The U.S. has the same problems that you see in the rest of the world, probably indeed a lot greater. Fiscal circumstances beyond control and containment. Our economy has not recovered. It's turning down again. None of this is being viewed too closely in the rest of the world. You've had a lot of hype, which has been used to prop up the dollar. But now the reality on the economy is beginning to come into play, and that in turn forces the Fed into a circumstance where maybe the Fed is going to be raising interest rates, and they talk back and forth and play games and trying to jawbone the markets. But the economy is weakening at a pace, and we'll see this in the next several months, that will pretty much forestall not only the Fed raising interest rates, but very possibly putting it into a circumstance where it will actually expand its easing, and that would be horrendous for the dollar. The reason behind the dollar strength has been what was due to a shift in perceptions that all of a sudden we had a better economy, better monetary policy, better fiscal policy. Well, that's nonsense, and all that's beginning to fall apart. As it falls apart, you'll find the dollars will be back to where it was a year ago, with the rest of the world not wanting to hold the Treasury securities and viewing the dollar as a long-term loss, which I know they generally do. You'll see that selling accelerate.
For those of our listeners who'd like to find out more about the work that you have online, as well as your newsletter and related services, please tell people how they can find the information.
The website is shadowstats.com. Go to the website and you look in the right-hand column. You'll see at the top of that column a number of free documents. Hyperinflation report is the standard of what I see generally unfolding, although it's dated 2014, the material in it holds. We're still moving along the general track of what I'm looking for there. We have alternate measures on unemployment, inflation, the GDP. Those are all available to visitors on the website on our homepage. And we do offer a, say, call it a weekly commentary. It comes out at least once per week, normally probably twice a week, depending upon economic releases, where the current numbers are analyzed, assessed, and put in the standpoint, particularly with the inflation and the GDP, what those numbers would be like if they used the older methodologies instead of the gimmicks that have been added in recent decades to understate inflation and overstate economic growth. We always appreciate any subscribers. It's not a real expensive newsletter, $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. And we do have in the left-hand column the headlines from the recent releases, so you can get a pretty good sense as to what we're looking at.
We'll look forward to having you back on the show.
Well, you're welcome, and again, thanks for having me, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I awoke this morning to Apple's announcement in my inbox that their smartwatch was now available for pre-order. Needless to say, I clicked straight through and examined the new gold watch. Depending on the model and the amount of gold present, the prices range from $10,000 to $17,000 each. The gold watch cases range by weight from 54 grams to 69 grams of gold, depending on the model, which converts to 1.9 ounces of gold to 2.43 ounces of gold per watch. Using $1,200 an ounce gold, that equates to a range of $2,280 to $2,916 worth of gold per Apple Watch. Other versions of the Apple Watch range in price from $350 to $750, with one as high as $1,100. But even with styling and craftsman surcharges, $1,100 is a moonshot from $10,000. So the question is, does the gold watch cost that much more to produce? Is it just a higher margin item? Or does Apple expect a significant spike or revaluation in the price of gold that has already been factored into the price of the Apple Watch? It's anybody's guess. Imagine if the price of gold shot up, but the price of the gold watch remained steady, at least for a while. I can see the headlines now. Will Apple raise the price of its gold watch to match the growing global appetite for gold? If indeed, as some have speculated, the demand for the gold watch, especially in Asia and China, consumes up to one-third of annual global gold production, Apple and the consumers who buy from them will become most likely some of the biggest drivers of the gold market. Apple is already getting some bad press, at least here in the U.S., because the various watch models all sold out within the first 30 minutes of becoming available, and wait times are now estimated between 6 and 8 weeks, according to MarketWatch. That demand and wait time may increase as the watches can be previewed live at Apple stores and the gold watches at select stores. Of the four Apple stores here in Las Vegas, only one has the gold watch for preview, and those preview by appointment times are going fast. I already have mine scheduled. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com, and if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Well, Martin Armstrong created the economic confidence model. He's author of The Greatest Bull Market in History and founder of Princeton Economics. There's also a big movie that's been made about him recently called The Forecaster. This is his debut appearance on Gold Seek. Welcome, Martin Armstrong.
Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't we just start off today with your movie? This is an interesting documentary called The Forecaster, and I wonder if you could tell us how it came about. You know, maybe how the producers contacted you, a synopsis?
Well, it's all basically done funded by European groups, including TV, etc. over there. So I think largely we have a problem in the United States, and I think everybody's beginning to recognize it with, you know, mainstream media, how they try to really suppress a lot of things, like Snowden, for example. If he had shown up at the New York Times and said, look, here are all the documents I took from the NSA, they would have said, gee, would you like a cup of coffee? While they, you know, stalled them waiting for the NSA to come get them, you know. Because honestly, I can tell you, I speak to people on Capitol Hill. And 2 years before Snowden, they were telling me nonchalantly over the phone, be careful what you say and what you put in emails to us. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, they're NSA's taking all our stuff. I said, your stuff too? And they said, yeah. So it wasn't like it was in some dark off room, you know, I got something really secret to tell you. So if they're telling me that openly on the phone, then every journalist in Washington, D.C. knew too. And that's why Snowden had to go to London, to The Guardian. And then the U.S. press comes out and goes, oh my God, look at that. You know, gee, isn't that amazing? We never heard of this, you know. It's the same, you know, so honestly, that's what I ended up having to do as well.
Most of the relevant news comes from the Telegraph, or like you said, the Guardian. I mean, it's overseas today.
Yes, United States is just, you have its own, largely the corporate media. And, you know, they're going to get a phone call, and I can tell you, I knew the executive, the number two guy at New York Post, and he explained it to me, you know, and he said, listen, they pick up the phone, and they say, we have a favor, and if you do not do what they tell you to do, he says, then they come after you personally for taxes or this, that, the other thing. I mean, they're now down in Australia. There's a scandal going on. That the same thing. They're going after the journalists for anybody that's leaking information to them. You know, government is just desperate to hold the line, and they, you know, prefer not to get anything out. So this movie is largely, it's sold out everywhere overseas. And in fact, I didn't even think it was going to get into the United States. And we had to tell people, listen, I'm sorry, you know, it's not going to be shown here. You know, they won't let it in. And all of a sudden, the company stood up and said, nope, we're going to do it. So it's actually debuting in L.A., I think the 27th, the end of this week, and then in New York, the first week of April. But overseas, they've largely called it a political thriller. It's going into the details of you wouldn't believe. I mean, they're actually trying to take over Russia, and there's you hear things. You know, a part of what's not in the movie, I would say, is that there is they had charged Bank of New York, which is primarily a custodian bank. And it's not one of the big money center type banks. They charged it with money laundering, the largest money laundering case in history, $7 billion. They actually steered this wire through Bank of New York. And then Republic National Bank, which is now HSBC, immediately runs to the government and says, oh, we think Bank of New York was involved in money laundering. So this is part of the movie. The bank, U.S. government runs in. It was them trying to take over Russia. And at the end of the day, what's not in the movie is that, you know, Bank of New York, you know, the two brokers finally plead guilty. No jail time, 6 months, that's it, go home. And the judge says, oh, well, okay, fine. Well, who was this money, you know, this money laundering for? And they just said, oh, a Russian businessman. Oh, okay, fine. Thank you very much. You don't even ask the name. And it's ridiculous. I mean, who could pay $7 billion as a ransom? And if somebody could pay that much, you would have heard it in the news that he was kidnapped, you know? New York is just absolutely, I mean, whatever comes out of there,
You know, it's not all that fantastic, though, for those of us who have read Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And then, of course, Frank Portnoy's Fiasco. Kind of see the writing on the wall.
All I do know is that it will be in the United States starting this week. Where it goes from there, I am not sure. I did have a meeting with somebody from Hollywood who I won't mention his name, but he said to me, he says, this is a fantastic movie. He says, but he says, you know, we got problems. I said, so what's the problem? He says, well, you know, Hollywood, we kind of have this self-censorship. I said, what is that? And he says, well, you know, if it's going to piss off somebody, we got to, you know, really think twice about it. So I guess ever since the McCarthy days, they eventually it will probably be on DVD, et cetera. I do know it will be shown on all. It goes to the network TVs in Europe, outside the United States, I think by October. See, you have a different attitude. I mean, here in the United States, those that would question what's going on in government are still in the minority. You know, and you kind of see it with the split going on in the Republican Party. You know, I mean, I think even Glenn Beck just came out and he says, that's it, I'm no longer a Republican, I give up. So you see a lot of discontent. And I've worked with governments around the world for 30 years, and I can tell you there is absolutely no difference between a Republican and a Democrat. They both know what buttons to push. They get everybody riled up over the social issues. When it comes to economics, they're the same. You have a real rift developing because you have financial and fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party. And Bonner has just basically cut deals with the Democrats to circumvent them. His own party. He hired people to deliberately try to defeat anybody from the Tea Party. Anybody that supported Ron Paul, he had him removed from any chairmanship of any committee. He's pretty bad, you know, and, you know, ironically, the conservative Democrats Republicans wanted to overthrow him. The Democrats are supporting them.
Jump into the debt issues that are plaguing the EU. You've compared this to the Detroit bankruptcy. Now, that was a city that was the hallmark of capitalistic success, tied in with deflation we're seeing around the world. And we're seeing more countries drop rates into negative territory. We haven't really faced anything like this since maybe the Great Depression. Give us an idea of what you see happening, please.
Well, a couple different aspects to this. One is that, honestly, I can tell you, the commission that formed the euro came to us initially, sat down, said, this is how it has to be designed. You have to, you know, consolidate all the debts, etc. They went through, and what they told me personally was that they didn't think they had the votes to get a consolidated debt, but they just wanted to get the currency in first. And then they would make that phase two. Well, then those people leave. I mean, you can find it on the internet. I published, you know, this thing is going to collapse. And but back in 1996, 97, this is a design. It's just impossible to work. And so that first, you know, people, they leave. And then you have other people come in, and they're like, well, what's phase two? Never heard of it. And so they defend the euro at the cost of absolutely everything, because they have created tens of thousands of jobs in Brussels, and they're only defending their own self-interest. That's it. The reason the euro could never survive is you take a big insurance company or something, life company, let's say they got $1 trillion, and they just want to be conservative and park it and what they think is safe government debt. Can you buy euro debt? No. It's at the state level. You end up having to say, okay, fine, well, let me look at Spain, let me look at this. You have to buy each one individually. They all have different credit ratings. So there's no one, you know, place to park your money. And it would be the equivalent as if the banks in the United States used state debt to back them for reserves. Then it depends, you know, and what state they have. Each one's different. So this is why the euro could never, you know, really displace the dollar. And by default, the dollar just keeps going up and up and up because it largely there's no other place to park money. You have to understand it from that big, you know, dollar perspective. And so Europe is a total basket case. The average German now pays more than 50% in taxes. The German municipal governments are all basically more than 50% of those are in bankruptcy. And the government's proposing to put on a 15% surcharge tax to bail out the municipals. The problem with governments, and this is on a honestly globally, because I've met with them in Europe here, wherever, they haven't funded a lot of this stuff. And people have heard, you know, unfunded liabilities, et cetera. But why haven't they? Because basically they just have always looked at this as that, well, we have the great unwashed, and they'll always be there. So why should they put money away? Because, you know, you're always going to have more and more kids, and therefore, you know, we can just grab, you know, whatever we need when we need it. They haven't funded this stuff. And then what happens at this point is very simple, is that you have the, let's say you take a municipal like Detroit. Detroit went down. Why? Because its budgets, all right, what was being spent, you know, exceeded 50% was going to pensions. All right, so you're no longer even funding the current administration. All right, so you take a look at it this way. You take a small, you know, municipality. It has 20 police. 10 retire. Now you still got to pay the 10 because you didn't put the money away to begin with. And now you have to hire 10 more. So the cost of government has been rising exponentially. And let's face it, you know, it's great propaganda. They say, oh, the 1%, the rich, the rich, the rich. What happens? Everybody cheers, yeah, yeah, go get them. They just take the money and put it in their pocket. It doesn't lower anybody else's taxes ever. I saw it in Australia. They had a great campaign for the luxury tax. We're going to tax their Ferraris, their fur coats, and their French wines. Everybody cheered, yeah, go get them. Okay, they passed the tax. What was in it? All electrical products. I mean, just these people, you know, honestly, if they had a bubble gum machine and they sold all the bubble gum and they spent all the money that came in, oh, gee, I got to refill it. What do I do? Oh, go steal some more bubble gum, throw it up again. That's it. You know, these people have no concept of how to run anything. And, you know, nearly 40% are lawyers. You do not have the person actually, or where are the scientists, the different fields, people having experience in different things. You know, all we have are lawyers. A lawyer knows how to write a law. He knows nothing about economics. He knows nothing about managing anything. And that's the problem.
If it all is geared towards one profession, the pendulum is going to swing way too far to one side.
Why do you think we don't get legal reform or anything else? All right, why is the cost of health care here in the United States so astronomically high? It's largely because of all the lawsuits in unlimited amounts. You go to Australia, other countries, all right, fine. If you get injured and you lose a left arm or something, there's a price for it. It's already set. Here it's like, oh, well, you know, he would have been, you know, Michelangelo, and he should get $150 million, and then the lawyer takes 60%.
Back, though, to the threat of deflation, cracks in the foundation in the United States. Now, do you see anything like Europe happening here once the dollar rally starts to fade?
The dollar actually has to rally a lot more first. That's capital coming here. The mistake that a lot of people do make with currency is they tend to think, they judge it like stock. So the dollar is going up, that means it's bullish. No, it doesn't. It actually makes the economy worse. Because the higher it goes, it reduces the exports, et cetera, et cetera. So that is really deflationary. It's not inflationary. So actually, a stronger dollar is actually what brings down the economy, all right? And if you just do a correlation, it's very interesting. The historical high for the dollar was during the Great Depression, you know, not at the peak. At the peak, it's on the opposite side of assets. So when the dollar's rising, assets are going down. And you see gold going down, a lot of things have been going down, commodities in general. All right, when did gold rise? It rose basically when our economic confidence model went down. It doesn't rise because of inflation. It rises when? It's clear when people lose confidence in government. It's a hedge against government. Then people panic because you don't know who's going to survive. That's why gold has done well during wars, because you're not then betting on who's going to win. So it's kind of like the alternative, you know, the third party type thing. And you have to understand that that's what, you know, is a lot of people misrepresented that it's, oh, it's a hedge against inflation. They sell it that way. It's not true. I mean, if you do a correlation with gold and against, you know, even $1982, we've published charts, you know, you see, it didn't take out the 1980 high. That adjusted for inflation, it's about $2,300 right now. So when it goes through these things and makes big, you know, spikes, it's when the confidence in government collapses.
Do you see a moment in the future where folks lose confidence?
I think that's largely coming after October, you know, and then you will be back to about a four-year period of really declining confidence in government, not just here but everywhere. Because everyone knows that there's something wrong. They can't maybe put their finger on it, but and you know, there's a lot of. I think that a lot of people get confused, and because there's too many pretend analysts out there that just focus on one thing, and that's not the way the world works. I mean, we've got offices overseas, and everybody is going to respond according to their own currency. All right, if I say, gee, you should be investing in Mexico, but the Mexican peso is going to fall by 50% and the stock market will rise by 25%, you didn't make any money. A Mexican did, but you didn't. That's very, very critical. Right now, the Europeans have been making a lot of money in the U.S. assets, real estate, stock markets. You don't see it. Whatever you see as far as the decline in the euro, 30%, that is what U.S. assets rose in value to them. But you didn't see the 30%. So, it you know, currency is very important to understand. And our definition of a bull market is when something is rising in terms of all currencies. Then now everybody's buying it, and you're getting a capital concentration. That won't take place because we have a lot of people, as far as government is concerned, very, you know, they're very skeptical. People are starting to question what's going on here. We have a fight in the Republican Party, and you'll see a rise in third-party activity for 2016 that we haven't seen since probably Teddy Roosevelt. But it's just time. That's when gold would respond. It's not going to respond at this point in the game. There's no reason to. You know, people are like, you know, all right, fine. You know, stock market's doing okay. I'm getting my check right now. So only when that sentiment of everybody changes, not just, you know, the small people that follow stuff, when you start changing, that's when you're going to see stuff like that move.
You mentioned the stock market, and for about 6 years now, we've entered one of the most protracted bull markets in American history, you know, in the Dow's 117-year history. But there's been nothing but naysayers the whole way. And as you mentioned, these pretendant analysts, you've got a pretty good solid track record with using your cycles method. You seem to be pointing towards the latter part of this year. Is that still, you know, in the cards?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, you've got everyone's saying, "Oh, stocks are overpriced. You got a, you know, crash." They're looking at it purely through American eyes, and I'll tell you why they're also wrong. Look at the rest of the statistics. You've got retail participation practically at historic lows, liquidity at like 50%. So why is the stock market up? It's because of what we're talking about. You have people that are smart money is very concerned about defaults by governments, and that's unilaterally across the board in Europe. Why are the bunds, the German bonds, going up, and they're like 130-some basis points, you know, beyond the U.S.? It's It's because everybody's betting in Europe that the euro is going to fail. So they've been selling all the other bonds, buying the German. Why? Because they assume that once the euro fails, they'll get Deutsche Marks. That's the big bet over there. So you just had, you know, the opening of the ECB in Frankfurt. They turned Frankfurt into a war zone.
Yeah, but you know, you talk about a failing euro. I mean, this would be an epic event worldwide. Is everybody going to be holding, as you say, German bonds and American dollars? What about the yuan?
Pretty much. I mean, China's got its own problems. Japan is kind of still pretty much a basket case. It's not going to, people keep thinking, oh, they got the highest GDP, debt, et cetera. But the government, effectively, the central bank owns 70% of its debt. They have extreme currency control, so nobody can really issue debt in yen. So it's not really a reserve currency. Europe will go first because it's largely such civil unrest rising everywhere. They've been threatening Greece with practically nuclear weapons, you know, and all they're doing is driving it closer to Russia. And at the end of the day, there is no real victory here. We're looking at largely what I call the collapse of socialism. This is like the second shoe falling. The first one was in 1989 when communism fell, okay? But we are still Marxists, and everything we do is all based upon Marx. People don't realize it, but, I mean, Marx's theory was government has a role, and it can manipulate society and force what it wants. All right, before then, what did we have? Laissez-faire. All right, so even Keynes, every economist, you know, has followed Marx. If you really, you know, put a couple of drinks in them, they'll go, oh, yeah, that's maybe. But they don't want to admit that they're Marxists, but they are.
Assuming you're not in the Austrian school, like so many of us here in the gold crowd who believe, as you say, hands off, please.
Right, well, that's I mean, you're always going to have the laissez-faire, you know, but I'm talking about the bulk of the people who are in control, all right? They're Marxists. It is something that government wants to hear, all right? They want to be able to feel powerful. And, I mean, I'll give you an example, because I've really worked with governments for a long time, and I can tell you the way it works. Let's say you're at the bottom of a hill in San Francisco. I walk up to you and I hold out my hand and I say, I just saved your life. What's it worth to you? And you're going to look at me like, yeah. And I say, how'd you do that? Well, see that car at the top of the hill? It started to roll. I jumped in the car. I put on the brake. It would have killed you, but I stopped it. Are you going to believe me or not? This is the way politics is. You know, I can walk down there and say, listen, if we don't do this, 25 million people will die tomorrow. And go, yeah, but what if you're wrong? They would rather have the event happen than be put on these big, you know, investigative hearings. Oh, we're going to find out who it is. They love that. You know, a politician knows he cannot run for office saying, vote for me because I saved your job. How did you save my job? Because I vetoed this or whatever, you know. Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would have lost my job if he didn't.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the FOMC meeting this week. You know, they dropped the patient terminology where they were going to wait. Dr. Yellen and company there, the Fed governors, changing their language a little bit, but they really still have agreed there's not going to be a rate hike as soon as April, maybe June at the earliest on their benchmark lending rate. Give us an idea of whether or not you think folks are waiting on the sidelines to see what the Fed's going to do, or will it be a non-event?
The Fed's between a rock and a hard place. And
well, they've painted themselves into a corner here.
The reason they want to raise rates is to get out of that corner. They're being lobbied by the IMF and everybody else because you have a lot of these emerging markets that ended up issuing a lot of debt in denominated in dollars because the interest rate was cheap. So if the Fed starts raising rates, then you're going to start seeing sovereign defaults and all the BRICS and stuff. A clash between international policy objectives versus domestic. This is one of the things I'm saying. Eventually, we're going to have some sort of international reserve currency that can't be the dollar. Because, the United States cannot then, the Fed is in a real difficult position because the stock market continues to rally up. They have to raise rates. If they don't, they're going to be criticized for creating the bubble. So this is, ironically, exactly the same position they found themselves in 1927. They lowered interest rates in the United States because they knew Europe was in trouble. And they were hoping to send the capital flows back to Europe under the theory, we'll lower rates here, the rates will be higher in Europe, so the money will go back there. It didn't. Looked at that and said, the Fed wouldn't have done this unless there really was a problem. So it came this way. Then the criticism of the Fed centered on that for domestic reasons. They said, the Fed lowered rates and that is what created the bubble into 1929. Not true. But if you look at it, the Fed then raised rates from 3% to 6%. They doubled it, trying to stop the rally. All right. When interest rates decline, that's when a bear market happens. Just look at it, 2007, all right, look at Japan, you had declining rates, the negative, basically, you have Europe going negative. This is not bullish. Again, it's people that do not understand the economy. Lowering rates like this, they think they're going to stimulate, cause people to borrow. They won't. They will not borrow unless they think they can make a profit with it. It's not the empirical level of rates. We've ran studies on all the interest rates going back a couple hundred years. The stock market has never peaked with the same level of interest rates twice. Why? Because if you think the stock market's going to double by next year, you'll pay 25%. If you think it's only going to go up 5%, you're not going to pay 3%. So it's the difference between expectation and the rate. It's not the empirical level of rates. That's why the stock market's never peaked at the same level twice. It's kind of like lightning that way. So the Fed will be forced to abandon international policy objectives and will have to raise rates. So we should see rates start to rise, and they're going to continue to rise probably into 17. And they'll get blamed internationally, but if they don't do that, they'll be blamed by everybody, every mainstream media, newspaper, and Congress, that you created the bubble, and the 1% have made so much money, and it's all your fault.
You're really taking the punch bowl, aren't you, away from the equities exchanges? Is that going to be the death knell for the stock market?
I don't think you're going to see the stock market really take off. The retail will get back into it only when, interest rates start to rise. And then we're in a situation which is opposite of 29. In 29, what was very interesting is, I read Galbraith in school, the Great Crash, etc. You talk about propaganda. You can go online and get Herbert Hoover's memoirs. And I would suggest looking at chapter 1931. Every history book that has ever been written, including Galbraith, all right, there's no mention of a sovereign government default. None. It's all big corporations, this, that, the money people, blah, blah, blah. Okay. City of Detroit defaulted 1937 as well. All right. They finally made good 1963. All of Europe defaulted, with the exception of Britain. They defaulted, called it a moratorium, then they came back. China defaulted. You can go buy their bonds on eBay. South America defaulted for the fourth time. That's what this Great Depression was about. All right, if you look at the chart carefully, you'll see the stock market fell, a normal correction, about 60%. All right, it started to rally out of 1930. Then what happens? All the foreign governments defaulted. Back then, instead of the mortgage-backed securities, the banks were selling foreign government bonds in small denominations. You had, Mellon. During at the crash said, well, gentlemen, buy bonds. Of course, Marilyn Monroe turned into bonds. But why? Because even the conservative people that bought bonds lost. There was nobody left standing. That is what makes a depression. The stock market will never make a depression. There's not enough money reserved in it. If you look at bonds, the amount of money in the bond market is at least 10 times that of what's in the stock market. If you undermine the bond market, now you've got serious stuff. Okay, you can take the stock market down 50%. That's not going to do anything. All right, economically, it's the bond market that's critical. And that's what we're dealing with here. All right, we're looking at a sovereign government default again. The last time was 1931. You can go back and you'll look, and it was 1842. You know, a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, Andrew Jackson, you know, he just got rid of the Bank of the United States. That was a terrible thing. Because then what happened, when he ruined the central bank, then all of these wildcat banks popped up. Every bank in the country started issuing their own money. They all went bust. The states then had to issue bonds to try and bail out those banks, and then they defaulted. So you had state sovereign defaults in the 1840s. That created a major depression then. So it's the same scheme. It's like a Shakespeare's play, basically. It's the same plot that's played over and over and over again. It's just that the actors change. That's part of government's solution, honestly, is because, again, they never take blame for anything. To them, they wouldn't have these problems if everybody paid. So what do they want to do? They want to eliminate paper money and move everything to digital. I mean, just look at it. I mean, you can look online. You can even buy. There were $10,000 bills they used to print in 1934. All right, the highest bill we have today is what, $100? All right, you can't even buy dinner with that. It's really, this has been a long plan. And they want to eliminate money as much as they possibly can. And in their view, if everybody, you know, if it's electronic money, then they get 110% of every tax.
Because there's no place left to hide if it's digital. Everything is accounted for.
Everything. I mean, and this is what FACT is about. They're destroying the world economy. Unbelievable.
As we wrap up here, Martin Armstrong, I wonder if you could tell folks where you're parking your hard-earned dineros. If you had to crack open the piggy bank right now, where would you put those funds, please?
Right now, basically, cash is king.
So you're expecting more deflation then?
Still, yeah, we're still in the deflationary mode. I would really kind of look at metals as a hedge type thing, but you're probably looking more in the fall. And just you have to understand what's going to make them go up. All right. And usually when there's a turn at the bottom, everybody's puking it out and nobody is like, never buy that again. All right. And the same thing at the top, you're getting the opposite. Oh, you better hurry up and buy because you're going to double your money by next week. So they're extremes, and you have to see that. And so right now we're not there in either side. So it's going to get much worse, and it has to. The euro is going to go under 80 cents. The euro is really, really bad. And most of these countries are really in pretty bad shape. Most people don't realize the worst debtor in Europe is actually Britain. Right now, I think, honestly, I would look at, you know, the stock market will make a false decline. That would probably be the time to buy, and then it should, you know, blast off again. I mean, if it gets to the 23,000 level in the Dow, now we're into one of those bubble type things. But our resistance has been in this 18.5 to 18.7 area, and it's been crawling. This is not what you get with a high. When it's a high, it's like a real bubble type thing. I mean, I was around for gold in 1980. And I can tell you, it went from $100 in 76 all the way up to the 400 area by December 79, and then it goes from 400 to 875.
Just like the NASDAQ, you know, circa 2000, 1999, 2000, I mean, you saw 200-300% increase in about a year. There's a zenith. There's a peak.
That's the bubble. You know, you see the same thing in 1989 in Tokyo. That's why I'm saying the stock market is not there. It's just not there.
But you know, one interesting parallel, though, you might notice that the NASDAQ, within earshot of that 5,100 or so peak, you know, that's what silver did in 2011. You know, it got back towards its peak, and then the whole house of cards imploded. Kind of raises some red flags. Now that the NASDAQ is back to its 15-year high, could we see something similar shaping up over the next year?
Oh, sure. I mean, you'll get a correction out of it, which will scare a lot of people.
The sentiment remains so amazingly bearish. Every time there's even the slightest little hint of a sell-off, and you don't see that. You see euphoria when you're really near the peak. When you're near the top, you can't scare the herd away. Every sell-off is where they're buying. The Jesse Livermores are selling.
I was giving a seminar in Tokyo. And it was just really for institutions, and this individual bribed his way through the hotel to get in. And he comes up to me and says, I apologize, I just really had to talk to you. He bought $50 million of the Japanese stock market the day of the high. Now, that was, all right, fine, you know, I figure a real speculator, but what made it more interesting, he was in his 60s. It was the first time he ever bought stock. And I met the guy that bought the legendary high. So I asked him, I said, what made you buy this on that day? And he said for 7 years, brokers had called him. Every January, the Nikkei went up 5%. For 7 years, he watched it. He goes, okay, they're right. He bought it the end of December 1989, just expecting to make 5%, and here it's down like 30, 40%, and he still had the same thing.
I mean, if you recognize you're in a bull market like the equities have been, you can actually buy the dips and not get nailed by those false breakouts that kill everybody, or like you had in gold and silver for 12 years. You could buy those pullbacks, so don't be the $50 million guy. The final trade at the top the market.
Yeah, don't buy the spike highs. I mean, you can buy a breakout of like the old high or something like that. But, you know, if this thing is like, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% above the old high, be careful.
Do you have any kind of target or forecast for the Dow Jones?
Our medium range target is probably in the 23,000 area. There is a possibility that if we exceed that and we see the capital flows really pour into the United States, then you're going to get a bubble here, like 2989 in Tokyo. And then the high would probably come in around 17, and then you're looking at anywhere from like 35 to 40.
The money will really be made on the downside when that thing breaks. I mean, there's going to be more Livermores making fortunes.
Well, you also have to ask yourself this question. If the amount of money in bonds is basically 10 times that of equity, and people get scared of bonds because it's government that's the one that's in trouble, where do you go? You know, and the only thing is private assets, and that's, you're seeing it in real estate, you're seeing, you know, who's buying the real estate? The Chinese have been buying all the biggest high-priced tickets. The Canadians have bought more real estate in the United States as far as numbers are concerned, that title belongs to Canada. If you're looking at New York, Florida, et cetera, the Europeans have been buying everything.
Do you see real estate peaking, though, along with the equities market? I mean, they tend to move pretty much lockstep, don't they?
It depends. The speculative side did peak out in 1927. That was the Florida land bubble. And then the stock market did continue higher for 2 years after. So they don't always peak together. It depends if it's a real speculative bubble or what. But right now we have a lot of money coming into the main centers area. So California, you see a lot. New York City. You're not seeing it in the house in the suburb type thing. That would be domestic. So the foreign money that comes in, they want the high-flying stuff.
So you'd still be a buyer here for the typical family home?
Well, if you're going to do real estate like that, I think, you know, honestly, we're heading towards more of an ice age rather than global warming. But there's energy output of the sun also has a cycle to it, which they tend to ignore. So each winter should be getting colder and colder. And so I would be looking at going south rather than north. But I would recommend that you try to basically hedge it, and you hedge it with a mortgage as far as you possibly can, but fixed, not floating, definitely not floating. And because that way, if anything ever happens, all right, fine, you get back into a real, you know, difficult, you can walk away.
There are some interesting cycles here that show many ice ages do and have occurred. We saw them during, you know, the Dark Ages and the bubonic plague. It coincided with a mini ice age. What do you see here as far as you talk about maybe a lowering of the solar wind?
Actually, the energy output of the sun is a thermodynamic system. So there happens to be about a 300-year cycle in it. It's a thermodynamic system, so it beats like your heart. It doesn't put out energy at the constant, you know, pace. The low of that was largely in the 1700s, and we've just simply gone into the peak. And I mean, you can see there, I mean, the Delaware River and in, you know, next to Philadelphia where George Washington crossed, you can see pictures of him, and there's icebergs in it. I've never seen like that. This is the first time that, you know, we did put a picture on our blog. There were literally, the sea froze up at Cape Cod, and the beach ended up, when the ice started breaking up, icebergs all over the beach. I mean, bigger, taller than people. So, unfortunately, the peak in the energy output of the sun has already taken place, and the cycle's already heading back down. And it probably, on the short-term cycles, it will most likely bottom around 2020 or so. So it looks like, at least for the next 4 years, we're going to get colder and colder winters.
You would certainly expect commodities prices, you know, as demand increases and supply wanes with the colder and colder temperatures, you lose your growing season. That could, you know, be an interesting opportunity for folks.
Yes, I mean, a lot of commodities in various different areas should start to go up when, you know, as the business cycle turns down.
Martin Armstrong, I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling folks more about the blog that you have there, all the services you provide, and any other contact information.
I would say you go to our blog. It's armstrongeconomics.com. We basically are institutional, and we do service the retail community as well. But we're pretty much everywhere. So we've got operations in Europe. We have Russian sites up and Russian Asia. So we're probably one of the largest international firms.
Well, there's a lot to digest and plenty to keep you interested, engaged, and entertained at this website. So I hope everybody will click the links we're going to have online to Martin Armstrong's websites. Thank you for taking time. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. It was reported this week that confidence among U.S. homebuyers dropped to an 8-month low. A Bloomberg survey was expecting a gain in the sentiment gauge issued by the National Association of Home Buyers and Wells Fargo from 55 to 56. Instead, that sentiment gauge dropped from 55 to 53. Part of that resulted from the fact that sales of single-family homes declined to a five-month low, and builder optimism about the industry outlook failed to improve. But there are mixed messages appearing throughout the housing industry. I spoke with a trusted friend in Florida yesterday who told me there are areas of that state's real estate market that are booming. Foreclosures are still rampant, but baby boomer relocations continue, and prices move forward. Florida may do well this time around as more boomers retire and more people try to escape northeast weather trends. Then I just read an article on drhousingbubble.com about the return of risky loans, the kind that helped augment the 2008 and 2009 collapse. One in particular by Freddie Mac, where they are now offering a 3% down payment loan that is called the Home Possible Advantage. There is also a resurgence of FHA loans and interest-only loans. Does anyone not see a repeat of recent history coming back? With a 3% down payment, if you need to sell your house, you're already underwater, with the average real estate commission being at 5 to 6%. But I guess everyone believes home prices are going to continue to go up once again. Then I heard Eric Sprott discuss in a recent interview that the next economic collapse will be worse than 2001 and 2003. Worse than 2007 to 2009. He believes if you take central planners, the Janet Yellens and government programs out of the market, it will become a no-bid market. A frightening but very plausible scenario. Because without a buyer of last resort, there is no last resort. And people who never imagined they would may start to resort to a much different way of life, including a much lower standard of living. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.